I'm Frank Gallagher, host of Soundman Confidential. It's showtime. Plug in. Today on Soundman Confidential, I'm very happy to be talking with a multi-instrumentalist who's worked with the likes of Bernie Taupin, Joan Armatrading, Stevie Nicks, Meat Loaf, Alice Cooper, to name but a few. His main job for the last many years has been as the musical director and the guitar player with the Elton John Band. Please welcome Davey Johnson. My guest today on Soundman Confidential has a vast resume. At the moment, and for the last lots of years, he's been the musical director and guitar player with the Elton John Band. And I'd like to welcome Davey Johnson. Say hello, Davey.
Hello, Frank. How are you today?
I'm fabulous. I'm now a resident of Flagstaff, Arizona, waking up in the forest here. It's quite lovely. It's a long way.
Beautiful.
A long way for Govan, but I'll take it. I'll take it.
There you go.
Now, Davey, you and I never met, although we were probably in the same orbit at some point in our lives, you know, over the years that the experiences I've had and that you've had. What are your earliest recollections of sound, and particularly sound in relation to music?
Well, that actually is my earliest recollection. My sisters, who are 10 and 12 years older than me, respectively, when I was about 4 or 5 years old, they'd be playing Elvis 78s on their record player. And when I heard Jailhouse Rock and Hound Dog, and they had a couple of Buddy Holly, like Old Boy and stuff like that, and Tutti Frutti with Little Richard, I would hear these, and that was my first, not only my first recollection, but it was the first music that really spoke to me, you know, that just grabbed me, basically. And it was like, immediately my feeling was, I love this, and I think this is what I might want to do and with my life. And from that moment, from those very early years, I've had this consistent love affair with music, and it's carried on to this day, and hopefully in the future.
Hi, we're about in the same age group. I'm probably a wee bit older than you, but I remember the 50s too, Elvis, and then the British copycat versions of that, Tommy Steele and Lonnie Donegan
and Cliff,
and
brilliant.
I grew up with that.
I was a massive Shadows fan because of my love for the guitar. I started playing guitar when I was 11, and I played violin at school from when I was 7 years old. God knows how that happened. That was what you call a God shot. Somebody came around the classroom and asked, would anybody like to play the violin? And my hand shot up for God knows why. I had no intention of playing violin, especially at 7 years old. But I did, and it actually really gave me a great grounding as to how fingering works, especially on an instrument. So it really got my understanding of stringed instruments at a very early age. So when I started playing guitar at 11, I was basically straight in there. I knew exactly what the deal was, you know, so I could immediately start copying Hank Marvin on the radio. And then a few years later, when the Beatles started coming out, you know, learning all George Harrison's riffs and then learning all Keith Richards stuff. And because I'm a good 11 years younger than those guys. So although I'm, you know, a couple of those are my contemporaries still, and I get to see them occasionally. It's just great for me to think that that's how I started listening to those guys and learning what they were doing. And, you know, it's just like life. I think in general, if you cotton onto something that's really, really top of the game, and that's what you aspire to do it the best you can, you're going to get some results. And I've been very fortunate in that area. It's what I love doing, you know.
Aye, and you also picked up some other instruments along the way. What was the progression from picking up the guitar at 11 and learning, and the first attempts at forming a group or playing with other people?
Well, you know, very early on, I formed a band at school with my best mate, Bryden Churnside. There's a name for you. Bryden and I were great mates, and we were huge music fans. We'd all be, and he played a bit of guitar, so we formed a little band called The Trolls. And The Trolls played around the Edinburgh area, like youth clubs. And we I remember one time we auditioned for one of those youth club dances, which was a big deal, you know, because we were 12, you know, and we auditioned for this youth club dance and we played Wipeout. That was one of our specialities. Unfortunately, when we got to the drum break, the drummer fucked it up three times in a row, and that was it. We were done. You know, sorry, we'll call you. Don't worry. You know, we'll call you. But no, from then on, I joined a band of guys who were much older than me. They were in their late teens, early 20s. And so they were really old as far as I was concerned. And but I worked with them playing, you know, Beatles stuff and all this, the top 40 stuff of the day for about a year. And then something clicked with me, and I heard a couple of things. One of the things I heard was I heard an Edinburgh Festival tape of the Dubliners featuring Barney McKenna. Now, the Dubliners were just the most amazing Guinness-swilling Irish folk group. But when I heard what they were doing with tenor banjo and fiddle, it just really screamed out to me. So I decided to learn the tenor banjo. And along the way, I learned the mandolin, which was also the same kind of tuning, which is in fifths. And I learned to play those instruments. So the fact that they were different than the guitar automatically, unknown to me, they gave me an extra advantage for what I was going to be doing in music later on. Because getting into folk music meant I covered other great players. A lot of Scots guys like John Martin, who was a hugely popular guy on the folk rock scene for a while. Unfortunately, John had a very crazy life, and it stopped all too short. It was an incredibly sad situation. But I adored John. I adored the Incredible String Band. I loved Bert Jansch, who was an Edinburgh native like me. And John Renburn, who is the English, you know, counter to Bert Jansch. And those great bands like Pentangle and Fairport Convention were actually what spoke to me more than regular pop music. So when I heard Led Zeppelin, see, Zeppelin in those days were playing the best. I mean, I love Zeppelin, but they also had a side to them that was totally folk. You know, I mean, Jimmy Page, his stuff, you know, with Black Waterside, different things like that. He was essentially, you know, doing what John Martin and those guys were doing, those great guitar pickers in Britain at that time. So I knew what he was doing, you know. I got it immediately, and I loved the rock side as well. So I was able to get all these influences and put them in my bag, as it were. So when I started doing studio work, I had all these different areas covered, you know. I would walk into a studio with an acoustic guitar, a mandolin, a banjo, and then a sitar, which nobody played really in those days. And that's kind of how it started. I started getting a lot of work.
Brilliant, brilliant. And let's go to your first studio experience, taking it from playing live and transitioning into the... So you learn your chops playing live too, because you can stretch out and pretty much do what you like. You know, you can jam, you can change the arrangements, you can do what you like. But you get in a studio and then you got a producer with an idea. What was your first experience of that?
It was good. I moved down to London from Scotland just before my 17th birthday. I just felt I have to. I'm done with school, you know. I mean, aye. I got on the A levels I needed to get, and the O levels in case I needed to. What is it they say? Fall back and get a real job, as my mum and dad used to say, right? And so I had that, and you know, I that's my cushion. So I made a deal with my mum and dad. I said, look, I'll have to go to London. I know a couple of guys in London that will let me stay with them. So I took off, got on the train to London with £11 in my pocket. So this would be 1967, almost 68, and stayed with a guy called Noel Murphy, an Irish guy. So when I started making contacts in London, which happened relatively quickly, and London is seen as like wildfire. If people hear about a good player, be it a good guitar player, a good banjo player, whatever, the word goes around really quickly. So I was automatically invited into people like Colin Scott, Canadian guys, Colin Scott, brilliant folk rock artist. He was being produced by a guy called John Anthony in those days. Magna Carta, they were being produced by Gus Dudgeon. And when I would get dates like that, those guys would talk about me to their counterparts, which eventually led to my work with Elton, because Gus also produced Reg Dwight back in those days, as he was known. But there was a brilliant experience when I'd maybe done three or four big dates in London. And it was still very new to me and still quite, you know, all right, I better have it together. So it was quite nerve-wracking. And I remember the night before, at my apartment, some friends of Noel Murphy's came in, and they were Danish, and they had the Afghan coats and the beads and the earrings and the whole fucking deal. I mean, these guys were serious hippies. They were the real deal, right? So one of them convinced me. I mean, I loved, you know, various aspects of, you know, hash and different things in those days, but he gave me this thing and he said, "You got to try this." And I was like, "Well, I've got a session tomorrow morning, so I'm not really, I don't want to try anything. I don't know what's, oh, it's going to be fine. Only lasts an hour or two." Well, 9 hours later, I had dragons climbing up my bedroom wall, breathing fire at me, and I was shitting myself. I was so terrified. By the way, sorry for the language. It's just the way I talk. You can edit it out, hopefully.
No, I won't.
Okay. So I got no sleep. I was totally freaked out. Anyway, I trundled along to the studio, got the tube, and went along to the studio in Great Portland Street in London. Got there, still a bit shaky and wide-eyed and all the rest of it. And I opened my guitar case, you know, in front of the producer and some of the other musicians that was there. And my guitar was painted totally psychedelic. And they kind of went, "Wow, that's cool." And I was like, "Christ, how did that happen?" And I guess sometimes during that 8 or 9 hours of, you know, psychedelia, I painted my guitar with no knowledge of myself. So I opened it to this, you know, wonderful, brightly painted guitar, and I was so embarrassed. But they seemed to like it, so I managed to squeak by with bullshit, you know. But I was very lucky because a lot of those guys took me under their wing. You know, the great session players, you know, like Herbie Flores, a wonderful bass player, Barry Morgan and Terry Cox, drummers, and Ray Cooper, who's a dear friend of mine to this day. Ray's just the greatest percussionist that ever lived. And he studied at the Royal Academy in London, where Elton did and where Paul Buckmaster actually studied, and also Chris Thomas, the great producer, who's a mate of mine. So those guys loved music so much, and they loved people who were trying to do something different and something interesting. So they let me into their little circle. So I was very fortunate. I was kind of a kid. I was brought into that London scene at a very fortuitous time for me. It was really wonderful.
You must have been a man who would take direction then at that point. Because that, for me, that was taking direction's always been very hard, because I always know better, you know. But if you're going into a situation with an artist, what are your recollections of that? The first time somebody said, "This is what we're looking for, and do it this way."
Yeah, but I found that, like you're saying, I found that a little bit difficult, although I was able to do that. But like you, I felt that my ideas are a lot better. And in a way, that helped me right from the off, because I could play what they wanted. So my usual MO was to say to the producer, "Okay, I can do that, no problem." And I'd play that part. But I'd say, "But I can also do this. And how about this?" So what happened was, after the first 4 or 5 times of behaving in this way, I found that most producers were hiring me because they wanted what I would play on the session. So that was very fortunate. For example, with Elton, Gus Dudgeon, who was my dear friend at that point, and I knew he was producing Elton's stuff, and he was just starting to get kind of looked at in America, and people were, he was making a bit of noise, you know. So on the Mad Men Across the Water album, Gus had hired me. And I came into the studio, met Elton, met some of those great studio guys that were there on the same date. But immediately I went straight into, okay, well, what about this for an intro for the song? Because it was obvious he didn't have a couple of intros. He just had the songs, which was great. But I would immediately offer, what about this? Like, there's a guitar intro on the actual song, Mad Man Across the Water. And I played him this thing. What about that for an intro? And he immediately loved it. So I was kind of in straight away as somebody who was giving him my real, you know, from the heart ideas that I thought would be musically good for the whole thing. So we've kind of always got on well because of that. And it was a method that I was to employ. Again, really fortunate, man, because you think about it, Frank. I was getting hired to play what I would play on a record instead of somebody saying, play this, which I'm not great at doing that because I'm a stubborn bugger. And I just think that many times I have a better idea. And I think if you're willing to stick to your guns and if your ideas are good enough, they're going to get accepted. And that's going to be a big step in the right direction. That was for me anyway. That's what worked for me.
Did you have to go through an audition process with any of these bands, or it was just word of mouth that brought you into the studio, and then from the studio that was basically your audition to get into the live band thing? Was that the transition?
That's exactly the way it would happen back then. And again, with Elton, after I did that session, on that session, I played on a song called Holiday Inn, which was the first track. On the second side, I think, well, in those days when you had side A and side B. And I played mandolin and sitar on that song. And Paul Buckmaster wrote the arrangement around my sitar part. So there was all this great thing going on. And again, if you were willing to share your own best ideas, you were right in there immediately with the whole thing. So, and also on that day, I think it was a 2-day, maybe 3 days, but wasn't that long, where we'd do, three tracks in a day. That's what you did. You did 10 till 5, and you basically got three tracks done. People don't work like that anymore, which is a shame, because it's you're on the line. You know, you have to get it done. But he did songs, Tiny Dancer, I played on the original of that. Leave On was on that album as well. So I'm hearing all those fantastic songs, and we're doing great versions of them in the studio. And people are going, well, that's it. Let's get out on the road and do them live. And in those days, Elton had a trio. It was Nigel Austin on drums and Dee Murray on bass. And that was it. They had no guitar player. So after the Madman sessions that I did for Elton, I got a call the following week. And it was his manager, that kind of slash manager, Steve Brown at that time, great guy. And he just called me up and said, listen, he loves what you do. Would you like to join his band and go make an album? I'm going, yeah, why not? Let's do it, you know? So literally without having met those guys in his band, I'd met Nigel briefly before, great guy, and I loved him and got on great. I'd never met Dee Murray. But the four of us got on a plane, January the 2nd, 1972, and we went over to France, went to the Chateau d'Hérouville, which is near Pontoise in France. And we made an album in 3 weeks, which, had Rocket Man on it, which obviously blew the doors off. And that was really the big kickoff for Elton's career and for us as a band at that time.
Wild, wild.
Yeah.
And how old were you at this point? You must have still been a laddie.
Yeah. By this time, I had just turned 20. So that was a trip, you know, doing all that, and then going to, you know, doing my first tour of America shortly afterwards. And I think I turned 21 in Kent State, Ohio, and it was like a couple of years after they had that, those terrible shootings at the on the college campus at Kent State. So when we played there, it was the anniversary. And when we went to the to go up on stage, I saw something I'd never thought. I was like, I'm in a dream here. There was like 50 National Guardsmen with the shields, the visors, the clubs, the whole thing, the tear gas. And I thought, oh, I don't like this, but it's pretty exciting, you know? And that's how I turned 21. It was like, welcome to America, you know? But, you know, the shows were brilliant. And that's when I really got the picture about how, about the distinction about America and the UK, because the concerts over there were just on a different level. There was more people. They were more enthusiastic. The Brits tended to be, well, depend, I guess it would depend who you are also. It took Elton a while to be really accepted in the UK. It took us as a band, even though we had a bunch of hits and all the rest of it. I think maybe there was a bit of envy amongst the fans that they didn't discover us first. You know what I mean? It's very, very strange. So they were a bit suspicious of us. They thought maybe we were a band who had sold out. That was a big no-no in the early days and whatever. And, you know, we were considered a very cool kind of underground commercial thing in America. So we were mutually accepted. But the UK was like, oh, those guys, you know, they're way too big for their own boots. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? That fine line you get between you're out there doing a solid job of work and just trying to get ahead, and you're frowned upon as some guy who's just working the system. And funny thing is, you can't just work the system. You've got to be good in order to get accepted by, you know, the general public. It's not a question of selling out. If, you know, if somebody can say, this is a surefire number one record, then I'll give them $1 million, because it doesn't happen that way. You know, hit records come out of the ether, really, you know?
Hi, good.
And people's, yeah.
Good songs. And yeah, I found that the difference between America, because I've lived here since 77, the, you know, you're a flash bastard, you know, flash bastard.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to go back a wee bit, Davey, that when you had your wee band and you were in Edinburgh and you were gelling as a unit, what was your recollection of the technology there, especially, you know, wee sound systems and then the progression of learning to and understanding the difference between good and bad sound in terms of what the audience were hearing?
Well, as far as what the audience was hearing, obviously that's never been my, I can't be on stage and be in the audience as well. So I would have to, I mean, I know what good sound is. I think what I learned from those very early days that was supremely important for me was the basic technique of miking an instrument up properly, or a vocal, or using the right mic for an instrument or a vocal. So there's a massive distinction. But I learned very early on, for example, where the microphone should go when you're miking up an acoustic guitar, say, and what kind of mic you should use. Well, in those days anyway, it was like a Shure, that's what you got for vocals, you know. But I started to develop a real understanding about what sounded better for acoustic guitar and the different mics that sounded better for piano, for example, that kind of thing. And knowing some of the guys that I knew who were engineers, sound engineers, or maybe producers who were also engineers. And in those days, most producers were engineers. Gus Dudgeon's a brilliant engineer, and he, God rest his soul, poor Gus. That was a terrible loss, and we lost him, I'm telling you. But he actually worked for Decca Records in the 60s as an engineer. And, you know, they did like Frankie Vaughan records and Kathy Kirby stuff and all the pop hits of the days, you know, in the UK. But that made him a brilliant engineer in the same way that George Martin was a great engineer and Jeff Emerick, those guys who worked on the Beatles stuff. And with their knowledge of how to mic things up correctly and about just about the beauty of how you mic a guitar amp, you don't have to mic it exactly the same way. You know, all these little nuances that the Beatles themselves exploited and learned those techniques and used them to such great effect, which I think basically changed the face of this whole business. Obviously, it became the template of how bands would record and how, you know, and the whole stereo breakthrough and all that happening. It's just unbelievable. But I've always loved the reassurance. I need the reassurance, actually, that we have a great sound guy out front. I've always known that. It's just a fact I've always been aware of. And right from the early days, we would always make sure the guy who we worked with had some kind of a good idea about, it's not just sticking the faders up, it's not understanding a bit about EQing and different effects that you might use, just, you know, as scantily as possible. We've been fortunate over the years to have the best sound guys in Elton's band. One such guy lives in New Zealand now, Clive Franks. Clive did all, as soon as I joined the band back in 1972, he was hot on the heels. About 2 months after I joined, he came in and was our sound man all the way through to the end of the 90s. Actually, no, the beginning of 2000s. And he retired and lives in New Zealand now. And currently, we have another monster sound guy, Matty Herr, who is from the Gene Clare, Clare Audio, you know, from Pennsylvania. Those guys are top of the line. So we've always, always sought out the best guys, because no matter how good you are, if your sound guy's not good, you're going to be shit out front. You know, it doesn't matter how great you are on stage. If your sound guy's not happening, it's not going to make it out front, you know?
Aye. Well, when I started, you know, expanding from the two columns and a wee Marshall amp or of a Texian amp or something, and I came to America, a guy said to me, an old timer sound guy said to me, there's only two things you need to know about audio: which mic to use and where to put it.
There you go.
And that's been my mantra ever since. Also, you know, I'm a vibe merchant. I'm not a technocrat. I mix the song. I don't mix the blinking lights, you know?
Right.
The blinking lights. Sometimes the blinking lights will stop, but the song will go on. You know, I learned that early on too.
That's right. You know? It's so true. It's so true. Now, you have to have a love of music, and you've got to have some technical know-how, obviously, where to plug the fucking thing in.
Aye.
But I mean, but most guys I know who have that knowledge, you know, they all learned their craft by maybe working, like Clive, for example, who I've been talking about. He learned right from the early days of starting in Dick James Music in London, and from being a runner up to start learning how to plug the mics in, and then go from actually being engineer in sessions all the way to going to do front of house sound. Now, as you know, there's a massive difference between doing live sound than there is from doing, you know, recording studio sound.
Oh,
it's a massive difference. You've got to be able to do things on the fly when you're doing a live gig, because things are not going to be perfect.
One take.
Stuff's going to happen.
You get one take, laddie.
That's it. Exactly. So, no, it's a hugely important part of the whole thing. And going back really a little bit earlier, but you were talking about sound and microphones and maybe a couple of columns. And I was fortunate enough to do a couple of things at the Edinburgh Festival again with the Corries. Now, the Corries, as you probably know, were
love them. Scotland. I love the Corries.
Yeah, they were the best. And they became good friends of mine because we played on their festival once. Me and a friend, Titch Freer, was a brilliant singer, and still is to this day, actually, in Scotland. He's still in Scotland. We were invited to play at the Edinburgh Festival on the Corries show at the Cali Theatre in Edinburgh. And their sound was always amazing. I mean, they didn't use electric instruments, but everything they used was acoustic. But still, you know, with that knowledge of where to put the mic and where to sing into it or where to put your instrument in order for it to be properly accepted by the microphone and stuff, I learned all that stuff back then. And the sound in the hall would be pristine. It'd be amazing. So that when I got into the thing of rock and roll a few years later, I wasn't impressed at all by what these bands were doing, because the sound wasn't great. because they were having to, the engineers in those days weren't equipped to understand how do I mic up a piano and get it to sound out front? How do I mic up an electric guitar even and have it be the same balance as the bass? You know what I mean? So it became to me very, very clear as to what would make a decent sound. You know, you didn't have to get one sound and work on it so that it was pristine. It was the way that bass fitted in with the guitar or the kick drum or the electric piano or whatever your instrumentation is. But I think that I learned it from just from the ground up, as you said earlier, knowing what mic to use, knowing where to put it. It's very, very, that's the essential of the whole thing.
You just took me back there. I saw the last time I saw the Corries was in Falkirk Town Hall, and because I lived in a wee village about 7 miles away from Falkirk, and I used to go at the folk club there and see them all, Matt McGinn and Hamish Imlach.
All those guys.
Like I say, we were probably in the same orbit at some point. We just didn't meet up.
Well, see, also from those days, I made one of my closest friendships in music and in life, which is Billy Connolly. And you know Billy. I mean, aye, I don't think there's a Scotsman alive who doesn't, you know, bow down to Billy as being just what a brilliant example of Scottish humour, for example, and Scottish music in those days, because that's how I first met Billy. He was a great banjo player. The Humble Bums played all these brilliant American folk songs as well as, and then Billy would start writing his parodies and some of the funniest stuff, the funniest occasions I've ever been in, actually witnessed in my life have been in Billy's company. And, you know, we opened together for different, like for the Incredible String Band one time. You know, he came to Live Aid with me. There's the other side of the coin. We've been friends forever. And just one of the most brilliant, brilliant people on the planet. And to this day, he's got a wonderful appreciation of music, always has had. And he still talks about, you know, people that are really relevant in the business that he loves. And he's still got he loves the Incredible String Band to this day, for example. He still loves, you know, well, obviously, Jerry Rafferty, his partner, which is another tragic story of Jerry leaving us.
Hi.
But they worked together for 3-4 years, you know, and it's wonderful. I think that it's great when you get people like Billy, to a certain extent like myself, who are willing to listen to all kinds of music and not just say, well, that's great or that's shit. Everything has its place, but it all is part of this whole thing that we do together, you know.
Aye. I was walking through. I lived in San Francisco for many years, and I was right, walking through Chinatown, and there was a guy busking with one of the three string. I don't even know what it's called, a Chinese, the fiddle that he was playing upright. He was playing Auld Lang Syne, and I started greeting.
All right.
It was like we're all one at the end of the day. And music, right. I was so fortunate that I got the music thing because I never wanted to be on stage, but I got the music thing because my dad took me to a dance, a fundraiser for the local football supporters club, who shall remain nameless, Celtic. and he sat me in the wings. I was maybe 11, 10 or 11, and he sat, maybe even younger, and sat me in the wings. And I watched this band, the wee pop band that was there, and I was fascinated. I wanted to know, how does this happen? How do these boys get from A to B and get on a stage? And I'm still doing it. That was where I got the join the circus. But I remember the shows coming, the Travelling Funfair coming through, and they're parked on a piece of waste ground, probably for centuries. It was a drover's trail. Centuries they were there. And I remember the diesel generators throbbing, and I remember bass on the waltzer. And I must have been 3 or 4 when I heard that.
Right. That's
and I never forgot it, and I've always been fascinated with bass. The low end. Yeah. I drive the low end, and I get paid for it. It's great.
That's not bad, is it? What a great thing to do what you love doing, and somebody's going to throw money at you. I love that. Yeah,
I love it. But I worked for nothing for years too. I didn't care. I was never in this for the money. I would have done it anyway, and I did it anyway.
That's interesting you say that, because a lot of my kids are, in fact, all of them are very musical. My son Charlie, who's 22, he just a brilliant piano player, and he went to USC on a piano thing because he's a great jazz piano player, and he did it. He just graduated this year, and but he's working down in a studio in North Hollywood here in California, and he's been there for the past few months, and he's doing what we all do, which is, doesn't matter what your qualifications are, you got to do the shit work from the beginning. You got to go and get the band sandwiches. You got to go make sure they got enough tequila or whatever it is they're drinking. And then you maybe get in to plug some mics in, and then you do this. And now he's basically, he's doing all this stuff for these guys at the studio, but you know, he's not getting paid. So, you know, occasionally I'll give him a little nudge in the ribs and say, so are they paying you yet? And you say, well, not quite, but you know, they soon will be. And I remember that feeling where you go, I love what I'm doing here, and I know at some point I'm going to have to stand up for myself and go, you know what, pay me something or I'm out of here. You know, so it's an interesting thing. You do it because you love doing it. And it seems to be, in my opinion, it's a necessary part of the apprenticeship. You have to do this work for nothing. That's what this deal is all about. And quite frankly, at the other end of it, at the end I'm approaching right now, when you get close to retirement, there's not a whole lot left. Nobody thinks of musicians' retirement, a musician's pension. I mean, even in the musicians' union, this kind of thing, they don't fucking look after you very well. Nobody does. So if you get fortunate enough in your career, you have to, I feel, do as much as you can for yourself to ensure your own comfort and your own retirement. You get all too old to do this kind of thing, and I'm fast approaching that. I mean, when we get back doing our farewell tour, which, you know, was stopped by COVID over a year ago, when we get back on the road, hopefully by the November this year, we still have 2.5 years of this farewell tour to go. So I'm looking forward to us doing that again, because we love doing the live thing, and Elton's such a great live performer. We've always had a great history of live stuff that's been successful, and I'm looking forward to getting back on the road again. But I know that this is going to be the last thing that I'm going to do live, as far as with the band and touring and stuff. You know, I've done it all my life, and it's, you know, it's time to go, fuck that, I'm done. You know, like, it's over. Plus, you know, to be honest, you know, I've worked with a few other people in live situations, and you know, there's nothing like the Elton situation, really. And I also, I've been very fortunate when I worked with Alice Cooper for a couple of years. I mean, that was like, talk about getting, you know, getting your feet wet in the hard rock, heavy metal area, working with Alice Cooper. I mean, it was brilliant. But, you know, for the most part, in my experience, if you have a great organization and great musicians around you, then that's all you need. Do the work, and the rest of it's going to follow on, you know. It's when people start thinking, you know, grandiose ideas and, you know, the unfortunate great thing of this solo album, you know, the lead singer leaves to make a solo album and suddenly the whole thing is, you know, gone pear-shaped. There's unfortunate things that will happen in any aspect of life. But, yeah, as you were saying earlier, if you have a great combination of things, and then you go ahead and you trust in it, and you enjoy it.
Aye. You know, somebody said to me, how many bands have broken up from under you? I said, all of them.
Right. Yeah.
It's a precarious thing being a roadie. And it's like your early days in the studio. It was all word of mouth. I've never filled out a job application.
Right.
In my life, people go, well, what's your resume? I said, ask anybody. Anybody that knows me. And because people see my, you know, I work with the Talking Heads and Simple Minds, and I still work with the B-52s, and I worked with
Buddy. When you worked,
I was with Buddy
Minds,
Guy, Buddy Guy for 8 years.
I know. I heard that from Denny, and, you know, we are mutual friend Denny Seiwell.
Yes.
Talking about you working with buddy guy. Wonderful. I mean, I love all these different forms of music that you just mentioned in that thing. Simple Minds, I wanted to ask you. Obviously, you worked with Jimmy and Charlie and those guys.
Oh, yes.
Was Mark Taylor in the band back then?
No, Mark was. I was there with Mick McNeil, with the original keyboard player.
Oh, okay.
Because I worked with him very early on. I was commuting between New York and Tory Glen in Glasgow. It worked out where the schedules didn't overlap. And I could do Talking Heads, and I did Simple Minds for a period. Over a couple of years it was. I was the best time of my life, popping back and forward across the pond.
Oh, absolutely. Great. Now, I knew Mark very well. We had a year and a half or so together on the road, which, you know, when you hook up with a guy who, you know, you say, oh, I know I'll be friends with this guy forever kind of thing. And we would go, we'd be the two who would always be at dinner together, be at clubs together after shows. We'd be going out and hanging out at a beach if there was a beautiful beach close by. We were absolute terrors on the road together. And this would be all in the early 90s. And
What band was that?
He became part of Elton's band. When Elton made his first album out of rehab in 1990, called The One. They weren't using a specific band. I was still the de facto guitar player, but he wanted to bring out the session guys for the album, and they were doing it in France. So Chris Thomas and him, well, I know this guy, I know that guy, I've heard of this keyboard player, and they decided to use Mark on a few tracks.
Lovely man.
And then I brought Guy Babylon from the US to do one half of the album as well. So it was like that. But Mark and I remain good friends. And there's always these people that you hook up with on the road who maybe you spot the twinkle in their eye or something, and you know, oh yeah, this is going to be fun. Okay, good. This guy's got good taste in books or music or women or whatever, and that'd be it. You know, you'd be off and running, you know. But yeah, this life's been very, very good to me in that area, the area of meeting great people. Meeting really great people, funny, intelligent, tragic, the whole deal. You know, you get to meet the whole gamut of great personalities in the music business. So I've always considered that, you know, just a really great plus to what I've done in my life.
It's a bit like, you know, a great song when you hear it. It's a vibe thing. And I actually know Mark from his days with The Alarum. And I was with the Silencers, a wee Scottish band, and we supported them on a European tour. It was my little exile in England in 1989 or whatever it was. I ended up hitting the wall in New York. So
there you go.
I got.
Well, there was a lot of closely linked stuff in right at that time. You know, especially between the 80s. And the 90s, just in that period, there was a very closely linked up, because after the whole punk thing started, which kind of cleaned up the scene in some ways, but it confused everything because drum machines came out at the same time. And for most of us who had 10 or so years in the business at that point, it was kind of an alarming, pardon the pun, but it was an alarming point in the business, because suddenly it was all keyboard players and drum machines. It was like, fucking hell, what happened to people who actually play, you know?
Aye, aye.
And it was a very scary point. I know a lot of drummers who gave up at that point and never played again, which is most unfortunate, because every producer realized, well, why do I have to hire a drummer who's going to bring all his problems and his big set of drums to the studio when I can just get a guy who'll use his index finger and get me a good drum sound straight away. So I thought that was an unfortunate period. I guess it had to be, obviously, we had to go through it, that whole technology thing, because right now, in the last 5 or 6 years, there's been a very big return to people actually playing their instruments.
Yes.
And I think that's a really good thing. But I guess it had to go through that. You know, we had to morph through that. That strange, uncomfortable period.
Had to hit a technical bottom. But the first time I heard the new Springsteen record, I got goosebumps, because I knew it was a real person and real people playing in a studio. It wasn't cobbled together. There was digital technology involved, obviously, but I could tell instantly it was a real drummer and real drums.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the technology. The technology is brilliant, but that's it. Now, when the technology is used correctly, you know, you can still have guys playing live in the room, you know, and it's going to be straight to your laptop instead of to a giant, you know, 36-track console or something. But it's the way the technology is employed, I think, that's important. And as long as the guys know how to use it correctly. I mean, again, going back to what my son's doing, he's totally been raised in the digital, you know, complete high-tech age, and he knows how to use all that stuff. But he also, being a piano player, understands the dynamics of actually doing that, of playing an instrument and then making it up correctly. And I think a lot of the young people are going back to that now because they realize they want to play live again. And I think that whole thing has been really, put under a magnifying glass for the last 13, 14 months since we haven't been able to play live. A lot of those kids are dying to get out there and show what they can do, you know. Because let's face it, no matter who you are, 99% of people that I've met in this business want to show, look what I can do on stage. It's very few of them who are like my dear friend Guy Babylon, you know, a keyboard player who's happy to sit in the background and play all this brilliant stuff, but doesn't need the adoration of the crowd. But all the rest of us, really, part of the reason we're doing this, we do this because we wanted, when I started playing guitar, it was I wanted to get a girlfriend, you know, and really nothing's changed. You know, that's what you do. You know, you inspire people who maybe don't play an instrument but love music. And they come and see a great live band and they're going, shit, this is what I love, you know. And really, I'm still doing it for that reason, to bring joy to the people who love music. And that's what it is.
That somebody said to me, why do you still do this? And why do the B-52s still do this? I said, because we bring joy, you know.
Yeah.
And we've got good songs.
Exactly.
What are your recollections of some of your favorite venues, sound wise and vibe wise, that you've played over the years?
All for different reasons, I suppose. But I mean, again, it's down to our sound guys and our monitor guys. Again, if you don't have a good monitor guy, it doesn't really matter how good the sound, how bad or good the sound is. If you have a great monitor guy, like again, we have a guy who's up from, you know, where you used to live, up from San Francisco area. He's from the Bay Area. Alan Richardson has been working for us forever, for, you know, 15 plus years. And this guy is ridiculous and loves and understands music, understands how to put it through your wedges or nowadays in your in-ears, which is what we all use because the sound is brilliant. You can pitch so well. Again, it's down to the guy you work with. If you can tell him, this is what I need, and this is what I like to hear. I like to hear a little bit less mid. I like to hear tons of good, solid low end and enough high so I can really distinguish instrument to instrument. But as far as just good venues that you can go in, you know, I've always loved, believe it or not, one of the places I loved in the early days was the Hollywood Bowl. And that was basically because we didn't play as loud. Later on, when Elton started to want everything on hell, you know, everything went to 11. That was it. You know, I mean, we were louder than the Who. We are still to these days. I mean, it's ludicrous the levels that we play to. But in the earlier days, when it was just acceptable, we would go into a venue, and because our sound guys were so good, Hollywood Bowl was great. Madison Square Garden was phenomenal. In Britain, for me, the Usher Hall in Edinburgh sounded phenomenal in those days. Again, before the levels got out of control. To me, when the levels became too high, when everybody had to have it so loud that it hurt, then everything went, as far as I'm concerned, it went to shit because people forget that if you play a little bit quieter on stage, then the sound guy can turn it up as loud as you want and it'll be better. But if it sounds, if you're on 11 on stage, the sound guy's going to have a hell of a time getting that to come out front properly. You know,
damage control is what it is.
Exactly. And you know, I know many sound guys who throw their arms up in disgust and disbelief when they hear what's coming off the stage. It's like, well, what the fuck am I supposed to do with that? You know, if everything's bleeding into everything else. So I really think, again, it's a thing about people understanding the dynamics and about each instrument and what you have to do in order to make the sound all come across to the public as best it can.
Brilliant.
And that's why, again, why I've always loved acoustic acts so much, because, you know, the sound guy's got a great shot, so you can hear each instrument. Here's my point about the whole thing. If you ever see a bluegrass band playing, right, especially in the old days, there was one mic.
One mic. I've seen it.
Right?
I've seen it many times.
The guys would move in and out when it was their time to solo. Like the mandolin player would walk up to the mic and walk back. Singer would move forward when he had to do the next verse. All the singers would move towards the mic when they were going to harmonize. It makes sense. It's just the way that you have to think in those terms. You know, it's about sharing. It's about, actually, somebody who mentioned, we were talking about this recently, was James Newton Howard, who's a brilliant film composer, and he played in our band back in the mid-70s. James and I have had a long musical history together and just a friendship. And he's actually up for his 7th Academy Award. I just got his 7th nomination for that Tom Hanks movie, News of the World. But we were talking about sound and about how that kind of thing happens. And he used the term, well, he's applying to me. He said, well, you're a very generous musician. You're willing to play your part and then step back and let the other sound come through where it's appropriate. And I love the term about being about generosity in music. Instead of going, look what I can do, and just jump to the front of the stage with a banana down your pants and go, look what I can fucking do. You know, it's not, you know, the other way, but to me, the more gentlemanly, shall we say, but having a bit of compassion and generosity for the other guys on the stage. It's what it's all about. It's not all about trying to be on hell before, you know, because that people get bored with that. They want to see something a bit different. They want to have highs and lows, I think, you know, for the most part anyway.
Definitely. Well, on a related subject, I got an inquiry from a guy I know in Salt Lake City, who's a documentary filmmaker, and he contacted me to ask me if there's anybody I know who would be willing to go on the record and talk about the mental health issues of a touring rock and roll band. And it got me thinking, you know, the toll it takes, because there's a lot of loneliness. You're in a hotel room by yourself, even though you're surrounded by people. It can be a lonely business. There can be the doubts, the creative self-doubt that comes up now and again. Could you speak to that in any way, your experience there?
I know that it's a massive issue. Every time we talk about or we hear about a great artist who suddenly passed away, and usually it's the cause is accidental death, which, as we know, really is just a euphemism for, oh, he OD'd,
right,
or he did too much, and he mixed the booze and the pills, and unfortunately, he never woke up, or whatever it might be. Those things that aren't talked about that much, or then whatever it is it the 27 Club? Is that what they call them? The age where so many pop stars and singers and like Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison and Kurt Cobain, they all died at a certain age. Whenever I hear about one of those, my first reaction is, there but for the grace of God go I, because you're absolutely right. And your friend with his, I'm talking about mental health, absolutely right. It's taken a huge toll on people all through, you know, the music world and the movie world. It's just been that's been the main thing. People get so much adoration and they decide they have to do this, and to stay in the public eye, they might do that. They may be very inhibited people, but they find if they have a few drinks and a couple of bangs of coke or whatever it is they need, they can relate to people, their inhibitions are gone. So this to me is the major problem. In order to hang out with a group of guys who seem to be handling it much better than you, so what do? You go to you decide to hang out with those guys and you end up in the bar every night. And then you'll maybe say, yeah, okay, I better take one of those bombers so I can stay awake for this drive. And it's just, it's awful what happens. It's, and I don't know anybody who hasn't been touched by this situation on the road. So it's a massive, massive problem. The one way that I can speak to it as far as my experiences are that I know that as we've had probably we've done probably more gigs than any other band in history. I just, a year and a half ago, I did my 3,000th show with Elton. Now, I don't know any other bands who've done 3,000 shows. There just aren't. There's not that many. There aren't any. That's basically it. We toured more than any other band in history. And even bands that, like the Stones, who are 10, 11 years older than us in age, they haven't done this many gigs as us. You know, we took touring as being, this is what we do. We're going to go out there. We know that by touring, we'll always stay in the public eye. People will know they can get a good show when they come back to see us, this kind of thing. So it worked in that way. It sustained our careers. But the price that came along with it to stay, to have that staying power, you know, that's what led us all to near distinction. And I went to the edge, hit the bottom of the barrel. And for my own thing, I had to totally clean out in order to carry on. And I've been fortunate that I was allowed to do that by my own actions and getting help from other people. Same with Elton. And he understands the problem so much that within our organization now, there are people involved with our touring group for the band, for the crew, for whoever's working with us, where they can actually, if they have a problem or they feel they're having an issue, they can go and talk to somebody within our organization. Who's almost like a, you know, like a guy who has experience. He's like a counselor who they can go to and talk to. And I think that it would be great if every band could employ this kind of thing. If it was part of the writer, okay, we're going on tour. What do we need? Okay, we know we need the bass player, we need the guitar player, the drummer, the keyboard player, we need the crew, we need this. But we also need to have somebody to go on who's on the road, who his job is to be there for people who have problems, and they're having loneliness issues, they're having substance issues. I think that nowadays that should be part of the group. And I know a couple of bands who do have that now, who they have maybe, they call them sober partners or whatever like that, and people that travel with bands or stars to alleviate some of their issues and talk to people who have experience in those areas, so they won't just go to, you know, sitting in their room and drinking three bottles of tequila and swallowing some pills and ending their career. I think nowadays you can have a situation where if you employ the right kind of experts and you're willing to talk to them, that's the whole other point that I think you know what I'm talking about.
Aye.
There has to be the willingness there that you are willing to admit, you know what, I'm really fucking up here. If I don't do something to look after my body or my mind, I'm not going to have a career much longer. And that's been the main problem. I think we've lost a lot of guys. You know, Michael Hutchence, Prince, Tom Petty, George Michael, the guys that we've lost for so many reasons. And in our band, there's been guys who've died for the same reasons. And it's so tragic. It really is. And it would be nice if there was an area that was understood by everybody where they could say, well, in our band, in our organization, we have this guy that's set up. Well, you can go talk to him if you have a problem. The more that that's brought to the fore, that it becomes a real thing, I think that will help bands in the future.
Great, great idea. I mean, there are some people working on that. There are some organizations within the business, but it's not the whole, I hate to say it, but managers like bands working, regardless.
That's right.
Regardless. That's right. Record companies want you out there working regardless.
That's right.
You can't take a day off. There's no sick days on the road.
That's right.
There's no mental health days on the road. Right. And I'm on the periphery of some groups that are involved with that, but it's very hard to make a dent. It's very hard to get the message across, you know.
Well, it is. It is because really, again, it's not until somebody has real problems with substance abuse or alcohol, whatever it may be, it's not until they have the problem that they're willing to hire somebody, or that they're willing to say, oh, I better get somebody to check me out on the road. So that means that it's not until you've acquired a certain financial or economic status that you can afford to hire somebody to do that.
Exactly.
So it's a very double-edged sword, you know. I just have a lot of faith in human nature as well, where I think if people are willing to talk about it, like obviously your friend is, and I'm willing to talk about it because I've been through that. I've been to hell and back. And I've seen so many of my friends. I've seen people who've survived, and I know how they've survived. And it's by being given a chance, but also by being willing to do the work where you stop doing the thing that's killing you. Do the thing you love doing, but forget about the other stuff that you think is part of this, or part of success. People, unfortunately, relate success to, you know, how much money and how much cocaine they have in their pocket. Look at me. I'm Jack the Lad. I'm driving a Maserati. I got a pocket full of cash and a pocket full of gold. You know, but that's not it. Because as we know, that's the kiss of death right there. You know, it looks great and it's fun and it's fashionable for 6 months, but it's going to kill you.
Aye.
It's like everything else.
Aye.
You know, so a lot of my friends, all the guys that I know basically have come up against this issue, and they're doing their thing to help, you know, and it's a huge problem.
Great. That's the first time I've brought that subject up on the podcast, but I think it's a subject that needs to be, that people need to be made aware of. Because I've got gold and platinum records on the wall from bands, but it doesn't buy groceries, you know.
It does not.
The little ego boost is great when it comes in the post, you know. But
of course,
then you've got to get on with it. It's a job of work, and it's a very important job of work that all of us do, crew and band, because we do bring joy and we do bring life. And
absolutely.
And that's so important. And I can't wait to get back. You know, I never thought I'd say I miss the airport. I never thought I'd say that. But I do.
Well, I'm not missing that too much. I'm not missing the traveling that much. Although, yeah, I know what you mean. That camaraderie that comes along with it is so important that you've got to have that. No, I couldn't agree more as far as getting back to doing this. As I was saying earlier, you know, this farewell Yellow Brick Road tour that we're doing, you know, we still have, it's just been it's been the biggest tour we've ever done, because everybody wants to see Elton and the band before we actually hang it up. So it's been amazing. And to suddenly be stopped right in the middle of that has been difficult. I must admit. I've enjoyed the rest. I've enjoyed being with my family, you know, getting to, you know, spend quality time with my wife and kids and my pets even, you know, actually being around, you know, that's been great. But yeah, I'm ready to get back out there and do this. And as far as what I see, I've been very fortunate because we've had a long, long career, which many bands aren't that fortunate, you know. So, and it's amazing to think that Elton, myself, and Nigel are still in a band together, playing together.
And, yes.
You know,
yes.
It's ludicrous. Nigel Nigel's, you know, 72 or something, Elton's 74. I'm going to be 70 in May. So suddenly it's like, Jesus Christ, we never thought we'd make it past 30. And here we are still doing it. So gratitude is the main thing in my life right now, that I've been able to do that. And still, I've got my health and, you know, as much as it can be right now. Thanks for all that. So what you do and what we all do, and I'm just going to continue doing it in that form.
Me too. It's been a pleasure and very informative, and thank you for taking the time.
Fantastic. No, it's been great chatting to you, Frank, and I've heard about you, as I said, through Denny. So, stay in touch, and I'm sure at one point when this is all over, we'll even hook up somewhere.
Have a wee cup of tea.
Perfect. Perfect. As long as it's Yorkshire Gold, that's become my
Scottish blend. I use Scottish blend.
Okay, well, bring a tea bag or I'll try it.
And a baked shortbread as well. I'm a baker.
Oh, shit.
Aye. Nae bother.
All right, man. Well, all right, my son. Yourself, Frank.
Thanks, David.
Great chatting to you.
So much. All right, my friend. Ta-ra.
Cheers.
Hey, thanks for plugging in. We can't do without you. And if you can, please consider supporting the show so that we can keep it running through 2021. Go to our website at soundmanconfidential.com to find the link and to check out our amazing upcoming guest list. Soundman Confidential is produced by Alan Black and Chet Bentley, web design by Adelaide Bell, original music by Paul Westwater, and publicity by Paddy DeVries at Devious Planet Media.